There's going to be some people who, despite, you know, their checkered history and checkered past, I think we can look inside and see that, you know, we can see a human in there. This is not one of them. No, we're not. No, this is not one of them. This is, if James K. Polk didn't fade into obscurity for his, like, I don't want to say incompetency as a president, because he did accomplish things. But, that's the best thing that happened to James K. Polk, was the fact that we've all forgotten that he was the president.
Hello and welcome back to the Buck Starts Here podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I am Kyle, the pig, and Eric's poke, and today we're going up to 11. Actually, I was writing this out, and James Polk, is that not the school that Al Bundy went to and played for when he scored 4 touchdowns in high school?
Yeah, first off, Ed O'Neill, America's dad. Ed O'Neill, that's the actor who played Ted Bundy and Jay Pritchard. Mm-hmm. No, Jay Pritchard? Yeah, Jay Pritchard in Modern Family.
Oh, yeah. Fine. He's one of my favorite actors.
Dude, he's so funny.
Right? All right, man, you promised us a redemption arc at some point, right? We're going to get to some good presidents here?
Tall guy, beard, in the Wrestling Hall of Fame. They'll be the next one we get to, who's not horrible.
We're on number 11 right now. That's 16. Yeah,
we got some time. Okay. Oh, no, I'm joking. There's gonna be some discussions here. There's gonna be some interesting people. There's gonna be some people who, despite, you know, their checkered history and checkered past, I think we can look inside and see that, you know, we can see a human in there. This is not one of them. No, we're not. No, this is not one of them. This is, if James K. Polk didn't fade into obscurity for his, like, I don't want to say incompetency as a president, because he did accomplish things, but that's the best thing that happened to James K. Polk, was the fact that we've all forgotten that he was the president.
Why did they make him the school for
because nobody knows
children.
Who he is.
Like, is that really all it was? Just a joke on the obscurity of him?
Yeah, there was I think I still have a copy of it. When I was a little kid, when I first started getting into comics, I was visiting some of my relatives in Rhode Island, and me and my little cousins, we like walked down this corner store, and they had comic books, and I bought a comic book that, as they restarted it, called Spider-Ham, mm-hmm. It's just like Spider-Man as a pig, and I just remember there being a bunch of James K. Polk references. I have that. I think I was the first comic book I ever bought, like, as like a little kid.
That's funny that somebody else made the pig and a poke. Connection there. I know that's misspelling because it's pig in a poke, not pig in a polk. But
I thought you're making a pork joke.
Oh,
the guy's name's Peter Porker, but like I think the news guy's like James K. Polk.
That's a good joke. All right,
I do love pork. Big pork guy. Right. What a good animal the pig is,
dude. Bacon is amazing.
Just
bacon,
God, prosciutto. Did not make a mistake with the pig.
How long are we gonna banter before we tackle this?
Well, I'm trying to figure out how long my heart medication I have to take. How I took it before I started this to make sure. Kyle knows we're joking because we were in the green room before this, but like, yes, I'm going to be very upset during this, and I'm going to try and be objective here. But we finally had somebody worse than Thomas Jefferson in terms of things they did in the White House. And just for a reminder, Thomas Jefferson, while president, made somebody
learn how to make mac and cheese.
Yes. So that he could go free, but trap his
brother.
Who had to learn mac and cheese in slavery for the rest of his life. And we're going to have, and that's not going to be the worst thing we learn about a president doing well in office.
Worse than Jackson, you think?
Oh, yeah. Way worse than Jackson. I would argue no president's done anything worse.
Okay.
Yeah. I feel totally confident in that.
Where do you want to start with him then?
Well, let's start at his birth. Let's start at the beginning.
Start bad there.
Let's start bad. All right. So he's born in 1795, November 2nd, 1795, in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. So in North Carolina will play a huge role in his entire life. I mean, we'll talk about he attended UNC, all that stuff. It is funny when we talk about presidents attending like modern schools that aren't Harvard and Princeton and William & Mary. Like, no, he went to UNC. Like, he'd be rooting for Bill Belichick to start having a good season. I will say UNC Chapel Hill, that is an amazing econ school. There's some fabulous economists out of there. Yeah, I feel like they don't get talked about. I feel like a lot of economists know UNC Chapel Hill is awesome, but I do always like to publicly be like, yeah, we all know like Harvard has awesome economists, University of Penn, Northwestern, all those places. But yeah, UNC Chapel Hill, man, if you ever want like some real, like even some of the papers that the university itself puts out, just excellent economists there. Can't wait for like people to be like, really? That's the most randomest thing I learned today.
I really hope they send you a shirt.
I think I have a Tar Heel shirt. Actually, they're not the Tar Heels. I forget what the UNC Chapel Hill. I forget what they are.
I don't remember.
So he's the first of 10 children born to Samuel Polk. I don't know why the name Samuel Polk is very funny to me. And then James Knox Polk, and they're both Scott Irish descent. So his father, his father was a very successful farmer, but he was a farmer in North Carolina in the 1790s. So he owned a lot of slaves, and his father used the slave labor to basically elevate himself, and he eventually became a judge. And I always find this funny because he had a reputation of being a family reputation for being disciplined and industrious.
Who? Industrious? How can you be industrious?
How are you industrious? What? That's crazy. You bought humans that you're forcing to work in literal slave conditions. You don't get to be called industrious.
I know, right?
Well, does that mean like I'm an expert flyer because I'm in an airplane?
Yeah.
I'm not even flying the airplane. I'm just sitting in the airplane. I'm a pilot.
Really good at swiping the card, buying the ticket.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. You have money. You're not industrious. Yeah.
Right.
So James K. Polk he had a very difficult childhood. So his he was horribly sick. He was frail, very similar to Madison, very frail, very sickly.
Said feral for a minute there.
Feral, yes.
Like that better.
But here's something wild. At 17, he underwent a surgery to remove a bladder stone or a series of bladder stones.
Holy crap.
Yeah, pre-anesthetic.
Ooh. Bladder?
Yeah.
Do we want to know how they got in there?
Bladder stones just from calcium buildup.
No, getting into it.
They just cut into him.
They just cut. Oh,
and he was left sterile after the surgery.
Shocking.
Yeah, not shocking.
Actually, probably about the best thing that we've heard so far in the story, judging by where it's going to end.
Totally. So he ends up. He ends up overcoming a lot of health challenges, but his family was emphasized very heavily the idea of education. They stressed a lot across all their kids, but specifically with James being the oldest. It's funny to call him Jim, right?
Yes.
Jim Polk is funny. That's a funny name.
Jim is a weird nickname for James. That does not – I don't understand
Jimmy
how
is
that
a weird
works.
Nickname for James.
It is too, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. His family emphasized education, self-discipline, which I just think is – I always thought that was funny that they were like, oh, they talk about self-discipline.
I know. Right?
But what ended up happening is that James K. Polk overcoming a lot of these health challenges, he ended up getting a reputation for just endurance. Like no matter how sick he was, no matter how crappy he felt, he would just keep going. So he ends up leaving his family around age 15 he's only gone for about a year or so. To an academy that's located in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. As he's gone, his family actually eventually relocates there. Mm-hmm. And he ends up becoming, very close with this gentleman, Samuel Black. And Samuel Black is this great, orator. He's this great mentor. He's this great tutor. He's a brilliant guy. And he teaches Polk about, one, how to speak. And speak in a strong rhetorical manner and an argumentative manner, but also taught him a lot about the classics. So,
taught him how to debate, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Like when I said rhetoric, I meant I know being weird. I'm actually like the actual word, like what rhetoric actually means. I don't think we use it that way anymore.
I figured it was better to just clarify that in case anyone else is confused.
No, he taught him to be wicked sarcastic. So he ends up, kind of excelling. At the academy, he ends up doing great under all these tutelages, and by the time he turns 21, he's a little bit of a late bloomer compared to most of the founding fathers. In 1816, he enrolls in UNC at Chapel Hill. That's why I brought up Chapel Hill, by the way. Like, okay. Just so everybody knows, sometimes I forget I have my notes. So he enrolls at UNC Chapel Hill, still considered, of course, an elite university today. He has some comically difficult to get into, especially even being a public university. It's because it is just excellent.
Both his parents still alive at this point? 21?
Yeah, but from what I understand, both his parents are still alive.
It's a record.
Oh, yeah. I actually, so his dad survives until 1827.
Dang.
So that's, till Polk's in his 30s, which might be, at this point, the longest.
I think John Quincy Adams had a dad live quite a ways.
Yeah, so John Quincy Adams has been in his late 30s, early 40s when his dad passed away, when John Adams passed away. Yeah, so you're right.
Yeah.
But his mom lived till 1852. His mom was born in 1776.
Holy crap.
Dude, yeah, I always think that's wild. Like, his mom lived almost to be 80. And I'm just like, wow, that's crazy for back then.
I wonder if people born in 1776, like, wore that as a badge.
I would.
Wore babies.
The biggest joke.
I would.
I'm better than you. I am the birth of America.
Right?
I think the fact that that A Wealth of Nations was written in 1776 is a sign.
I did not realize that. That's amazing. That's my new favorite coincidence.
Yeah.
Or not.
So he goes on to UNC Chapel Hill, ends up developing a reputation for being very, very studious, highly serious. He's described as highly disciplined, and he ends up graduating in only 2 years with top honors and earns a degree in mathematics.
Really?
Yeah.
Everyone else has been law degree so far.
So he gets a degree in mathematics and in the classics. So he was a dual major. He became known for his excellent memory and his rhetorical skills, which is funny his debating skills that he picked up under Samuel Black. Now, Kyle, you mentioned an attorney.
Yeah.
He immediately starts apprenticing as an attorney.
I don't think you can be a politician without being an attorney.
Yeah, right. Monroe, I think, was the only one we had so far that was not a attorney.
No, but he was also shot crossing the Delaware.
He's kind of a badass.
Yeah, he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, I like Monroe. Died without slaves.
Yes.
Born slave, died without slaves. I feel like that. And he was the one too. Oh, he's not Van Buren. We had to give it up because New York became a free state. oh God, I feel so bad for Monroe. Like, he really struggled with the discussion of slavery. He really did. So he ends up moving up to Nashville. He interns under this guy Felix Grundy, who's just like actually like super prominent Tennessee lawyer and politician. Mm-hmm. But he's cool because he's a lawyer before he's a politician. So as he's apprenticing under Grundy, so Grundy's like really really understands Tennessee law, like state law, and it kind of really resonates with Polk, where Polk's like understanding this methodic way to view politics, where instead of people, a lot of people see law through the lens of politics, he sees politics through the lens of law.
Interesting.
So this ends up becoming his like kind of obsession, and like I mentioned, Polk started a little late in going to college, but he ends up passing the bar and being admitted to the Tennessee bar in 1820. So he actually ends up catching up. So he creates this really interesting guy who is an attorney, like many presidents, has a very strong math background. Let me tell you right now, UNC Chapel Hill math today is elite. Mm-hmm. It was elite when Mr. Polk graduated too. So he ends up, becoming kind of this weird political animal. And so he moves to Columbia, Tennessee.
He's in Tennessee during the time when Mr. Jackson was running around in there. Did their paths cross at all during this time?
He ends up becoming a huge fan of Jackson. And when he enters politics, shortly after he starts his law practice in Columbia, he ends up becoming a Jacksonian.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump your notes again.
No, it's just good timing. Again, sometimes I feel like you can see my notes. And it is fascinating to me. So he ends up, this is kind of interesting, he ends up starting this law practice in Columbia, Tennessee, and it's instantly profitable. Like, he's studious, really? He's aggressive, but he's also considered dignified. Now, I want to, as much as Polk's going to get a little dark, don't get me wrong, but I'm going to be an honest interpretation, he starts making less wealth. It's not on the backs of slaves. He's just a good attorney. Mm-hmm. And what ends up happening is people are like, hey, we have this attorney. He's very, very sharp. He's, graduated this great university with a He has a mathematics background. He's a good businessman. And he's just kind of almost robotic in his ability to, you know, endure through challenging cases. So he ends up getting a ton of legal work with local elites and political figures, specifically those who were aligned with Andrew Jackson and in the early Jacksonian movement.
Mm-hmm.
By 1823, Polk is like, I'm going to run for the Tennessee House of Reps. And he runs as a Jacksonian Democrat supporting Andrew Jackson's populist, anti-establishment, whatever you want to call it, platform. And so while he's running, he advocates for these Jacksonian principles. He ends up getting elected. So while he's serving in the Tennessee House of Reps, he supports all these internal improvements. He actually gets heavily involved in the restructuring of taxes because he wants more equitable, fair taxes. When I say more equitable, fair taxes, I don't mean only benefiting the rich and stuff. No, I mean he's legitimately trying to structure what we'd consider a modern taxing system.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a very big supporter of suffrage.
Really?
For white men.
Oh, white men.
Yes, just...
Well, not white women.
No, nah, just white men.
Just
very
white
specific
men.
White men. Like,
wow.
Enough to where I have that marked from three different sources I've read. But it was interesting because he was very prominent, very influential in the tax structuring because of his math background.
Didn't they
his
math have background suffrage to be able to argue. For what? Sorry, I just want to go back to that white men's suffrage comment again. They've always had the right. Who needs to advocate for them?
It was only landowning.
Oh, he wanted to. Oh, well, that's where that originated from, the idea that only landowners would vote.
Yeah.
Oh.
And no, there was something behind it. I'm just saying it was not an impressive hill. If somebody's like, you support suffrage, you're like, oh, what a good dude. And then it's like, know, oh, right? No.
Dig a little deeper.
Dig a little deeper.
Turn the page.
Ooh, <whoop. laughs> So he, as he kind of establishes himself as, this great orator, this great, rhetorist, and just really a true politician. I'm not trying, I know that can sometimes be seen as a negative, but I don't mean it that way. I mean, as a real politician, somebody who's able to stick to a platform, communicate clearly, and build a coalition to the past what he believes in, he starts gaining a lot of this notoriety among the Jacksonians. But more kind of interesting, though, is that he opposed the establishment of a new state bank because he saw it as something serving as an instrument. He described it as an instrument of elite control, which is interesting because what was Jackson's big thing?
Banks.
State banks.
Yeah.
It didn't really seem to derail his political ambitions.
No.
Or his political prospects. And again, that's because Polk wasn't necessarily in there arguing the way a Jacksonian would argue. He was very much more arguing in the way a John Quincy Adams would argue. He's arguing the idea. The idea is not arguing him. He's not saying, I believe. He's saying, this is the best system. And that can be dangerous if you have such a radical wing like the Jacksonians. And he's part of your team. It can be very dangerous going against him. It can be very dangerous because the last thing you want is the very sensible guy explaining something. The worst thing you could possibly have in any discussion is one dude who's just this idea, it never says I, doesn't get emotional. It's just explaining it. And you have all these attorneys who know he's a wicked good attorney. He has a math background and all that stuff. They're like, maybe we just don't address Polk on this. Maybe we just let him vote the way he wants to vote. Yeah. We just don't touch this.
You don't need to weigh in on this one. We got it.
Yeah. So 1825 rolls around and he gets sworn in. So it's election 1824. He gets sworn in 1825 to represent. This is at the U.S. House, the U.S. Reps. As a U.S. rep. So he rolls in. He's representing Tennessee's 6th District. And he immediately aligns himself with Andrew Jackson and the emerging Democratic Party. So what's important to note is that Polk joined the Jacksonian Democrats. Well, the Jacksonian Democrats are still part of the Democratic Republican Party.
Yeah, this is during JQA's presidency.
Exactly. Bingo. Yeah. So this is, he comes in literally during JQA's presidency. So he ends up serving in Congress. It's very interesting. He serves in Congress for 14 years, 1825 to 1839. He's in there a while. And so in his first year there, he aligns himself with Andrew Jackson, becomes one of the first Democratic members of Congress. He's considered part of Jackson's most loyal congressional coalition. He was one of the vocal critics of the quote-unquote corrupt bargain of 1824. Though at this point, he's a very junior rep. He doesn't
what
really
was
have
the criticizing
a lot
of the
Oh, what he probably meant to criticize was the fact that Andrew Jackson tried to do the corrupt bargain, not John Quincy Adams, the president who you would vote for today versus Andrew Jackson, who you'd probably vote for prison.
It was a little ambiguous the way you said that. I just want to make sure.
I'm just telling you what people who write about him say. He did, so he ended up supporting Jackson's veto of the Second Bank of the United States and supported the Indian removal policy. So we're already starting to get down the dark side of Mr. Polk.
Didn't take long.
This is something cool, like how history threads together. So James K. Polk was actually the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee that supported and pushed through all of Jackson's fiscal reforms. You know, he was the one who supported hard money mm-hmm. over paper currency. He was opposing the high tariffs, which, you know, he was also during the tariffs of abomination.
Yeah, like, so didn't they put them in?
Yeah. But the highlight of his career at Congress is he's actually voted Speaker of the House in 1835 and becomes one at the time the youngest and still one of the youngest to ever hold the position. It's 1835. He's 40 years old.
Dang.
Yeah, that's pretty young to be the Speaker of the House. Actually, I think he would have been 39 at this point because his birthday was November 2nd. They would have elected him in March. He is a big reason why the modern Democrat Party exists today. Obviously, we're not talking about modern politics with the Democratic Party. We don't talk about modern politics.
Nope.
But he was the first one to reinforce the idea like a Democratic Party in Congress. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that parties don't form like organically. It's not like a bunch of people show up. And this actually happens in some coalition style governments, but even that's becoming less common. We're like, hey, a bunch of people get together and they form a coalition, we call ourselves something.
So the instances that we've seemed to cover, it's more like parties form around strong individuals.
Absolutely, bingo, right? And sometimes, like we see with the Whigs, is that those parties fade from existence because mm-hmm. they never really constitute themselves. We've had tons of parties. We've had the Federalists. We had the Anti-Federalists, which some people argue was never a party. I think there's a good argument that it wasn't a party, but I'm just saying a lot of times consider that. We have the National Republicans. We have the Know-Nothing Party. We have the Free Soil Party. We have the Democratic – we have the Democratic-Republican Party, which is like the second most presidents are from – or third most presidents are from that party. But what – becomes interesting is how do you constitute these parties? Mm-hmm. And you can make an argument that like Abraham Lincoln was what constituted the Republican Party, right? It became a statement because of the Civil War, right? And then you could argue that then Ulysses S. Grant's presidency confirmed it. In the same case, you can make an argument that the Democratic Party was formed out of the aftermath of the Jacksonian Democrats splitting from the Democratic Republicans. Just something I'm always clear about. The Jacksonian Democrats pre-existed Democratic Party. They were part of the Democratic Republican Party. They broke apart, but it was really, you can make argument that it was James K. Polk who stepped in and said, no, we are a caucus in Congress. You are a Democrat. You are part of this party. You can make a large argument that, well, it was Andrew Jackson who formed the Democratic Party. I don't think we should ever argue that because that's really what happened. He was the one who split it off.
Yeah.
It was Polk that is the unknown, is the less thought of name that actually solidified it.
You wouldn't say Martin Van Buren winning the re-election would be the one to solidify that?
No, I have a weird one with Van Buren because he won it.
He kind of broke away from him too.
So this is and this is also before Van Buren. This would have been like 1835, 1836. Okay. Yeah. So this would have been like kind of right when Van Buren's getting reelected.
Yeah.
I think Van Buren deserves credit for it too, dude. Like I think there's many people who do it. I just think Polk just doesn't get mentioned a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I think we kind of think of Polk as this guy who came, you know, pretty far after Jackson.
Yeah, I think you make a good point that there's the formation around the strong individual. What do you do when that individual's gone? Like something has to carry on. Otherwise the party fades.
There is an argument to be made. It's not a good argument. And please, you can yell at me. People can yell at me at that. Is that John Quincy Adams running his second time was a National Republican?
No.
No. He throws something through the screen at me. I think you could argue against that. Don't get me wrong. But I think at that point, the Democratic Republican Party, post-1824, had split. And I think you had a bunch of sub-parties. And you had the Jacksonian Democrats. And I think you had, I'm going to call them the National Republicans. I think if you, a different reality, John Quincy Adams wins, you see a party called the Republicans, and I think you see people coalesce around him.
Do you think John Quincy Adams wins the first time if the party isn't so fractured? around Jackson initially?
Does he win?
Because he doesn't really even campaign.
I think he still wins.
Think so?
I think he still wins.
That much respect?
What, my reasoning's crap, but my reasoning is if you didn't have the three-fifths compromise, Junkwood Adams waxes the floor with everybody. I mean, she just beats the crap out of everybody. He did not get one vote as a product of the three-fifths compromise.
Right.
Think of that. That's crazy. That's impressive.
Wow.
You're probably saying, Eric, what does that have to do with anything? Well, I am an economist, so I believe primarily people make economic decisions. And unfortunately, because of slavery, that slaves were not allowed to be industrious. And therefore, just counting people who literally don't have the right to vote in the Electoral College because it's based on population, I don't think that somehow counts as economic vote.
Right.
And I think at the end of the day, if you look at the people who are industrious, they tend to be the people who influence elections. And so, yeah, I would make the argument that I'd make the pure economic argument that, it's all the rich people who were industrious and who didn't have to rely on slavery who voted for him from those states.
All right. I won't argue.
That would be a good what if. That's a good one. If he wins that second term, do we have a party? The Democratic Republican Party was gone.
Yeah.
So he ends up serving till 1830. He ends up serving till 1839. He presides over, three really big issues. He presides over debates on the national bank, federal spending, because it's under Jackson, and westward expansion. And by every account, no matter what political party you fell into at the time, spoke very highly as him being a very efficient, very, very efficient Speaker of the House. He passed many things through. He held pretty open debates. His big knock is he was horrible with the gag rule. He did. Mm-hmm. He would push any slavery discussion to different committees and stuff like that. There's some contemporary historians who have some pretty good sources that Polk's opinion was to discuss it, which would make more sense with somebody with such a rhetorical background that he would want to debate it. Yeah. But he basically was like, being what a Speaker of a House does, especially Speaker, which is like, follow your party. It's like you're basically representing your party's control. So interesting side note. I did want to bring up the gag rule. So he leaves Congress in 1839 and becomes the governor of Tennessee. So he immediately left. So there's this guy, the current, kind of interesting little story here. So the previous the previous governor of Tennessee was this gentleman, Newton Cannon, who was
good name.
Yeah. He was a Whig too. And he was kind of like the first foray into Whigs and really senior leadership. So this is 1839. So this is before Whigs were voted, before William Henry Harrison, obviously. And so he goes in there, ends up getting the guy kicked out. And how did he get the guy kicked out? Was his entire political campaign, his loyalty to Jackson, and like Jacksonian democracy, and his hatred of Whig financial policies. Oh, so this is a route. This was like an old school route. Like, we are voting you out because we don't like you.
Jeez.
Kind of interesting, though. So he ends up... So he ends up winning, and he thinks he's walking into this like, sweet, I got this mandate, I'm going to have a great time, like this is what I'm going to do my stuff. So he gets in there, and he immediately starts funneling money into internal improvements, like roads and canals in Tennessee, pretty popular.
Okay.
And then he's like, cool, I'm doing all this great stuff, I'm this Democrat, I'm going to try and start consolidating Democratic power hold in Tennessee. No, it didn't work at all. So he ends up, he's very popular. Democrats at the time aren't popular in Tennessee. So every district, not every district, but the vast majority of districts re-elected their Whigs.
Right.
And the Whigs kicked the absolute crap out of him.
Really?
Oh, my God. It's beautiful political maneuvering. And it's very funny because this is the first time in Polk's career where he's been on the opposite side of the political maneuvering.
Right.
And it's a worthy opponent for Polk. And I think in some of Polk's writings, he's even kind of like, this is the game. He's not even like angry. He's like, oh, I'm just losing.
Maybe he learned from it.
Yeah.
If anything.
Yeah, he definitely did. So he ends up. So he ends up getting a lot of stuff he wanted to have passed, like the canals improvements and the road improvements, are getting passed, and he's expecting to be gaining all this ground, and he's just not.
Right.
Because the Whigs are just outmaneuvering him, and it kind of stunk for him in a sense because it wasn't like he was fighting one other person, right? It was that he was fighting the whole entire legislative branch.
Right,
and
right.
The legislative branch was acting as a coordinated entity. Remember, the Whigs came to power by knowing how to act as a political machine. He's in there right after this is very shortly after Van Buren ends up winning, gets essentially four different Whigs in different parts of this country with these mini political machines. They just turn this political machine on Polk. And Polk's like, oh, crap.
He was the test run before the Harrison campaign.
Yeah, exactly. and so he's like, oh, this stinks. So he ends up, election 1841 pumps around, a new Whig candidate, this guy James C. Jones. I looked him up. Interesting stuff about him, but maybe for a separate discussion or shorts. He ends up getting tossed by this dude. Like, just, and so poor Polk is like, let me try something again. And so he runs again in 1843 and gets his teeth kicked. Like,
really?
I don't think the votes were that far off, but everything I could possibly read, it was just like he never stood a chance. And he's kind of like, not confused, but he's kind of like, oh.
I'm confused because this is only a year away from his presidential campaign, which is going to be successful.
This is 1 year away from his presidential campaign. Yeah.
You can't win Tennessee governor re-election, but.
Yeah. And I think it was because the Whigs had so solidified movement against him.
How did they get so strong in Tennessee, which was, I thought it was like Jackson's like political base.
Radicalism by reciprocity. Being so radical on one side pushes radicalism on the other side. And also, don't forget, Whigs were fairly moderate. Whigs weren't extremists by any standpoint. And the Whigs had figured out that recipe of like, oh, wait a minute. If we like kind of ignore the slave issue, which isn't a good thing to say, but if we ignore the slave issue or run candidates that are also opposed to the slave issue, we can get some stuff done. On top of that, they don't believe in the same, anti-infrastructure investments and anti-interstate infrastructure investments that the Jacksonians do. Tennessee is a large crop-heavy state. It doesn't hurt to have some good roads and canals.
Very long and very narrow. Weird, yeah, really good to have roads in that.
I like Nashville. I went to Nashville. I like Nashville.
I love Tennessee, man. Yeah. I love Knoxville, man. The eastern side of Tennessee is amazing.
Yeah, I feel like it's weird to say, like, oh, I've been to Tennessee, and it's like, where have you been? Like, just Nashville. It's like, oh, that doesn't count.
Oh, that's it?
I've only been to Nashville.
That's it? Yeah. Oh, you got to see some more, man. You got to go to Memphis. You got to check out Beale Street. Beale Street's awesome, dude. If you love blues.
Yeah, so Kyle, just like you said, 1843, he's like, I'm going to go back. I had a lot of success. Like, it's weird. He was in Congress for 14 years.
Yeah.
And he couldn't even survive 4 years in his own state after he had been a rep in that state, had all these political connections, was a Jacksonian. So he's like a little disheveled, man. He's like,
also, you just got a bunch of good stuff passed too. Like, you're getting things done. Like, how are you?
He was not an incompetent governor, sir.
Right.
Like, he was very far from an incompetent governor. He just couldn't win the politics. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time in his life, I think, he's ever been on the opposite side. And so despite these back-to-back electoral defeats, Polk was like, do you know what? I still have gas in the tank. You know, he's still a young man. He's relatively a young man at this point. He's only 50 and 49, I should say. And he actually maintained his prominency on the national level. It was seen as one of the, you know, key Democratic figures on the national scene. And Andrew Jackson loved him. You know, Andrew Jackson kind of saw a little bit of himself kind of in him.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of like just endurance and stuff like that, that just ability to push through different issues. So Van Buren's like, hey, he proposes, you know, he goes for the Democratic nomination in 1844. And here's where it gets kind of interesting. So there's all these different people running. And John Tyler Jr., as Kyle likes to say.
Thank you.
John Tyler Jr., they know he's not running again. So yeah. The Democrats are feasting. The Whig Party's kind of in this awkward position where they're going to field a candidate, but they know the candidate's very weak because having a Whig president who you got to throw out of the party has fractured the party a little bit.
A little bit.
And it's a weird time in history. So it's seen as a clear run-through for the Democrats. But the Democrats are very nervous. The defeat of Martin Van Buren by William Henry Harrison was kind of bizarre. And this is a fledgling party. So this ultra-populist Jackson, they get Jackson's number two to win. And then they're handily defeated by a new party run by an older gentleman who, you know, is he that popular? Yeah, Tippecanoe and Tyler too, right? The Battle of Tippecanoe is well-known. But as we discussed about William Henry Harrison's seen as a political administrator. That's what he's seen. He's seen as a very good war mind and a political administrator who then defeats the founder of your party's protege. Like, so the Democrat Party's like, oh, what the heck? They can't figure out.
Baby, stop enacting into tariffs of abomination and destroying the national banks.
But it really comes down to the economy. That's the Democrat Party.
Exactly.
We're like, oh, damn. Like, we gotta figure this out. And so 1844 rolls around. And Jackson endorses. Now, this is kind of weird. So Jackson early on endorses Polk. Not necessarily saying vote for Polk, but saying I like Polk, right? And Van Buren's like, so Martin Van Buren, he's trying to get the nomination again. And Van Buren has a lot of support.
I didn't realize he tried again in 44. That's interesting. Yeah.
And so they end up having the Democratic National Conventions in Baltimore, the 1844 one. And it comes down to one issue. One issue derails Van Buren's primary.
Tell me it's slavery.
No. That would be interesting.
That would have been the redemption arc for Van Buren would have been completely.
He does eventually run for president on that platform. So we can give him credit there. And it's the annexation of Texas, which, again, has to do with slavery, too. So I don't. It was like he was running as emancipationist, but it's there. It's a turn of the arch. He ends up running for Van Buren ends up not being able to stomach annexation of Texas on the party platform. It is promptly thrown away. Hmm. And Polk, by positioning himself as this compromise candidate, the dark horse candidate, he ends up getting the nomination because the convention goes into deadlock. And Polk, who supports the annexation and Western expansion, was nominated.
That was his major ticket item, wasn't it? That was his campaign item.
He was nominated on the 9th ballot. It took 9 ballots to get a nominee. And this is early politics, too. Like,
dude, how long does each ballot take to...
Oh, it's an exhaustingly long process. Even at the state level, it's exhaustingly long. And he runs on this for lack of a better term, he runs on this very pro Manifest Destiny platform. And he ends up, I always find this funny. So his president, the president who he was, okay, so he's nominated because he was willing to annex Texas, right?
Yeah.
His running mate was George M. Dallas from Pennsylvania.
History's weird sometimes.
It is. But as we kind of close out the beginning of Polk, or I should say we close out everything prior to Polk's presidency, Polk, early on his campaign, decides to adopt a campaign slogan that we probably all remember from school, 5440 or fight, which obviously refers to U.S. claim to the Oregon Territory's northern boundary, the idea of Oregon's northern boundary isn't, I don't want to say it's on the top of every American's mind. It is symbolic of his desire for Manifest Destiny and Western expansion.
Yep. Yeah. That was one of the few things that I remember looking up was that I found it interesting, but we're going to probably cover that when we get to his presidency about how he oversaw basically the largest increase in territorial expansion in the U.S.
Yeah. There's also an argument that it's a large expansion of population in U.S. history, too.
Interesting.
Yeah, this is a very, very... We're going to get into his presidency, and then I'm going to ruin everybody's opinion.
Do they start counting slaves as people at some point during that?
Three-fifths of people. Like that. There, so I was reading this...
Why the population really went up?
No, but that's... So there's an interesting... I don't know if this is going to make an end, but there's something interesting, Kyle, that you might find out. The Three-Fifths Compromise, right? That, it was the abolitionists and the emancipators who were against it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they thought they didn't want slave states to have more voting power. So they were actually trying to get slaves not to count in the Electoral College.
I thought that was obvious.
No, there's people you talk to about that who think like, oh, isn't it nice that, you know, they were counted towards electors? It's like, no, they were just giving power to the captain.
Because they don't actually get to exercise any of that. Yeah. It's like saying like, hey, you get to vote, but you don't get to do it. They're going to do it for you.
Yeah, it's
what
a horrible idea. But yeah, that's his, we're there. We're at his presidency, and then we're going to get really dark and disturbing when we come back.
It's probably a good spot to end it for part one then. So join us next week because we're going to take sides in the Mexican-American War. Now, while you're sharpening your bayonets, you can jump into the comments and give us your best predictions for the outcome of that conflict. Whoever has the most accurate prediction is going to win something. Email us at buckstartsyourpodcast@gmail.com if you're worried about cheaters. Uplift those thumbs, subscribe on your way out, visit the website to stay up to date. We'll see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.